Thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to the kitchen table today. It's so nice to have each and every one of you making a choice to be here with Michelle and I and our stove hounds in the kitchen today. It's so nice to have everybody with us, and what a beautiful day it is. So let me begin by introducing our executive producer and co-host.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Miss Michelle York, how have you been all week, huh?
Very well. Thank you very much.
Of course, we've been two ships passing in the night all week long. Huh?
Yes, we have. Yes, we have.
I thought I'd have a couple hours with you yesterday, and then you kind of disappeared, but I disappeared too, and we were going the same direction. Went to New Orleans.
I know. You to the restaurant and me to the library.
You to the library, where both of us spend most of our time, huh?
Here of late.
And across the glass wall, keeping us alive and well and keeping our sounds balanced. And our music dynamic, I hope today, is our engineer.
Always. The music
our engineer,
is always
the
dynamic.
What's going on, huh?
Oh, not too much, but I tell you, we're looking over that website, and I think there might be some nice edits coming on in the future.
Well, I hope so. You know, I've been trying to get that simulcast camera right up here, which only would take about 5 minutes. Michelle said, we cannot do that. It's about her hair. she'll up here in, like, you know, these running pants and chills.
Oh.
You know, she jogs a lot. She doesn't want earphones messing up her coiffed hairdo. So, I mean, I've had a hard time getting that camera up there.
I'll take one for the team, and we can put it up.
Anyway, Michelle, you know my good buddy, Mr. B, right?
Oh, yeah. Love Mr. B.
Mr. B, I hadn't talked to Mr. B in a good while. Mr. B, all of my buddies out there, that's Mr. Bradford. And Mr. Bradford is known lovingly in Donaldsonville, Louisiana, as the photographer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's taking everybody's pictures from, I think he goes back to Lincoln. I think he shot a lot of the Civil War pictures in around Donaldsonville. Mr. B just keeps on ticking, thank God. And he is a great, great photographer, but he's a fabulous raconteur, right? What a storyteller he is. And when he and Andrew Capone come together, then it's
that's
real.
When the storytellers can
that's
meet.
When, yeah, the storytellers won't meet until the two of them get there. I ran into him yesterday, and we were talking about, so remember when he found my camera at Walmart? He was desperate to get me a lighter camera because I happened to mention one day that my camera was too heavy. Then he went on a mission to find. He said, John, I found the perfect camera for you. It's really light. And he said, you want me to pick it up for you? I said, yeah. How much is this? This is a cheap one, $2,200. It's really. I said, Mr. B. Mr. B, did you take your meds today? I said. Anyway, I saw him yesterday, and I told him that we were doing a show today, and I was talking about our guests, and that we'd be doing a show on the floating palaces.
Mm-hmm.
He went berserk, and of course,
really?
You know why. His family was one of the leading steamboat families in Louisiana. Milton Bradford, they had a lot of the Packard lines, but they also had the boats that carried, obviously, people all over, and farm equipment and horses to New Orleans. They were in the racehorse business, so they had boats that picked up racehorses from plantations, and he could tell great, great stories. And he said, John, to my knowledge, the John D., John David, my name, right?
Mm-hmm.
The John D. Graves was one of the last large passenger and freight boats that went up and down the river, and he said it caught on fire at the port of New Orleans, as so many of them did back in the very, very early 1900s. And he says, my great-grandfather who had founded the company, and then my grandfather, and then my father, who eventually ran it, said, you know what? The John D. Graves and the F.M. Owens, their two last boats, would dock together, both of them burned in the middle of the night. And he said, you know what? I'm done. But he was telling me the story. He said, you know, at one time, he said, I remember as a young boy, because he's about 90, you know.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a young boy, I'd go out onto the levee. There were about 15 of those big old boats with those stacks smoking. He said, man, Donaldsonville was covered black, he said. Anyway, what a great story. But, you know, you and I have been talking. I've been fascinated with a new book that I got in the mail recently, the Delta Queen Cookbook. And I was thinking that since we're coming up on Christmas, and what a great story to tell about the lavish lifestyle and meals that were served aboard these Mississippi River legends. And of course, I'm sure the Christmas season was just a perfect time, like the spring was, to just light up these gorgeous places, huh?
As you mentioned, the Steamboat has a very colorful legacy. I mean, everybody is familiar with the Steamboats. Mark Twain and his fascination with it. And didn't Scarlett and Rhett have their honeymoon on board?
Beautiful boat. Remember the suite they had? It was Robert Fulton, the father of steam navigation, who gets credit, of course, for building the first commercially successful steamboat in 1807. But, Michelle, it was 19 years earlier that the first U.S. steamboat patent actually went to Isaac Briggs and a guy by the name of Longstreet. Now, that's not to be confused by Stephen Foster Briggs, who should have been from the South. He's from Wisconsin. And he founded the Briggs and Stratton Engine Companies. A lot of people think that that's the Briggs that did the steam. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Fulton did give us the design of the New Orleans. And, of course, our guest brought me a menu here today, one of the early floating palaces that steamed into the city in 1812. And that was a very important year as well.
And didn't Teddy Roosevelt's great uncle,
the great granduncle,
he piloted that ship?
Absolutely, he did. And you know, the steamboats figure so prominently in the history and building of our nation as well, with construction improvements like the invention of that nice shallow flat bottom, mm-hmm. safer boilers, which I'm not sure how safe they were, the use of coal. It was considered a very cost effective way to move produce and people and goods, as the Bradford family did, and actually prompted the funding of the Erie Canal. The boats did.
Well, you know, and the steamboats connected the continent. I mean, they connected north and south, east and west, and they carried everything. They carried mail, they carried commodities, they carried livestock, they moved passengers. In fact, they helped in immigration from the Atlantic coast to people heading west. And of course, for those seeking gold.
And you know where there's gold.
Luxury.
There's luxury and there's people where there's gold. And by 1849, steamboating was in its heyday. Now, this is 1849. People don't realize just quite how early mm-hmm. the steamboats were on the river, because there's such a short history eventually when you look at it. But, I mean, it was there a fairly long time. There were about 11,000 steamboats on the canals and rivers. And the floating palaces were a favorite of some of my family, the slick-haired gamblers. The banjo players and Michelle, some of the ladies of opportunity.
That's a nice way to phrase it.
That's right. I mean, wherever there's slick hair gamblers, there's ladies of opportunity and banjo players.
But you know, by 1856, a railroad bridge actually spanned the Mississippi River, and there were blockades from the Civil War that were really running its toll on the steamboat. Of course, once the war ended, the steamboats were able to run again. But the trains had become a preferred method of transportation and a preferred method of moving cargo around.
But competition is always a great thing, right? So you had the steamboats there, the railroads are coming into being. And the steamboats rose again quickly by targeting a new customer, the very, very extravagantly wealthy.
Rhett and Scarlett.
Yep, this is the Rhett and Scarlett. The steamboats became more luxurious. They became the way to travel for the jet set of the day, so to speak. The J.M. White and the Robert E. Lee were the most luxurious of all of the steamers. The core was what we call steamboat gothic, with this overstuffed furniture. And Michelle, you will remember how many times I drove you past the Bell House in Donaldsonville,
yes.
right on the corner, and I said, that is steamboat gothic architecture,
yes.
remember?
Yep.
Because it's
many
right
times.
On the river, and it
yep.
was right where Fort Butler was located right there. I'm talking about chandeliers that are gas powered. I'm talking about skylights of beautiful stained glass. I'm talking about the dining rooms and casinos. And steamboats rival some of the finest hotels in Europe. Travelers were attended by stewards and cabin maids. And of course, like Revolution, only the finest china and only the finest linens on the table. And, of course, service unequal in the universe, I would say.
And, of course, all of the delicacies on the table.
Yeah.
You know, calves liver with onions.
You notice how calves liver with onions always instantly become the first thing of choice or conversation when you talk about prominent meals of the old days. I'll tell you why in a minute.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing, because you don't think about that as being a delicacy, but it was, and you see it, as you said, on many menus.
That's because you didn't know Mr. Chewing Gum, the butcher from Vassar.
Anyway, other delicacies, mackerel, beefsteak. They even had plantains, and what made that so great is it was an imported luxury. hominy stewed chicken, hot chocolate, claret.
And that was only for breakfast.
That was breakfast
that
only.
That was breakfast on the steamboat. That's exactly right. Unbelievable. And steamboats, y'all, exemplified all of the opulence and the extravagance of this Victorian era. But unfortunately, automobiles were becoming more fashionable. Trains were faster. And by the early 40s, that great love affair that had been on for so many years with the steamboat actually ended.
But the good news is that the California Transportation Company decided to build two steamships, the Delta Queen and the Delta King. They cost $1 million each, and they were christened in 1927. Now, one of their first jobs was to carry lobbyists between Sacramento and San Francisco. Very interesting part of their history, I think. The voyages had luxury staterooms. There was orchestra dancing, sophisticated restaurants. The King and Queen were big hits, ran to capacity. And do you know what one of the biggest attractions were?
Yeah, I know. Alcohol. Prohibition.
Absolutely right.
People needed to drink, and then you talk about the ladies of opportunity aboard.
They never knew exactly how alcoholic beverages got aboard. They got on unnoticed.
Yeah, yes, of course. I mean, who could see things like this? Anyway, y'all, alcohol seemed to be non-existent, as Michelle said. Low alcohol and near beers were sold, and anything stronger that happened to find its way on board. Eventually, given the crash in the Great Depression, even that failed to keep these beautiful luxury liners, as we call them, afloat. And as I say, by the 1940s, the two boats made their last trip. Y'all, we are talking about a great era on the Mississippi River, and I say everywhere else, but certainly the Mississippi River. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking about holiday feasts fit for kings and queens, and of course, we're talking about the luxurious cuisine and architecture, these beautiful floating palaces, and we'll be back in just a little while. Call about 700 of your friends. Tell them to tune in. They do not want to miss a word of what we have to say.
Can't you hear that old brass band playing? Giving the Queen a round of applause. Stoke her up and get that big wheel turning. Smoking down the river.
Daddy Cecil here. For 2 hours of word sound power, Rasta Reggae Radio, it's Jam On. Jam On, Sunday nights, 9 to 11 p.m. Rebroadcast Saturday mornings, 1 to 3 a.m. here on KRVS.
There's a car, truck, or boat taking up space at your house, and you're finally ready to do something about it, KRVS just might be the answer. Your vehicle could be used to support public radio in our community through KRVS's car donation program. One phone call is all it takes. Whether it's running or not, we'll come and get the vehicle, send you a tax receipt when it sells, and you just supported KRVS. Call us now at 877-KRVS-887 or visit our website at krvs.org to learn more. And thanks.
I never lost 1 minute of sleeping cause I was worrying about the way the thing might have been.
You know that
big wheel keep on turning.
Everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. Today we're talking about feasts fit for a king. We have to take a little look into the great, great history of those wonderful steamboats. And today we're talking about the feast and the foods on the menus of those wonderful floating palaces that plied the Mississippi and the rivers of this country 200 years ago. And Michelle, you went out of your way to find the absolute perfect guest today.
Thank you.
Say, this person wrote the book on the subject.
And she did. Cynthia Lejeune Nobles. She is the author of the book that you were thumbing through last night, The Delta Queen Cookbook. We're delighted that she's in the studio with us. You know, Cindy grew up in Iota, Louisiana. You know, that's crawfish and rice country. You're like Charles.
I know where Iota is. I've gone through. The good people of Iota have welcomed me in often with my PBS cameras.
I know that they have. Well, Cindy earned a degree in American history from UNO, University of New Orleans. She attended Cordon Bleu in Paris, where she took a course in, I love saying this word, boulangerie, you know, bread making. She teaches classes in the Baton Rouge area, cooking classes. She writes a monthly food history column for The Advocate. She's a member of the Newcomb College Culinary History Writers Group. You know, she had the privilege of actually contributing several chapters to New Orleans cuisine.
Oh, my God.
We love this book.
Yeah,
we just featured it a few weeks ago.
Yeah, we love
this
book. Absolutely.
We're delighted to have her with us to talk to us today about the Delta Queen Cookbook and all things lavish on the menu. Cindy, welcome to Stirring It Up. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Chef John Foltz.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to have you in. And I remember the day I saw some little card about the book coming out. I said, I want two of these right away. So I got on the website. I don't know if I was the first person to order that book, but I bet I was close to the
You were very close, and I remember very well. You emailed me,
I
got right back to you.
I did. You did. I was very happy about that because I was so excited to see that book because we had done some work. And, of course, I said, oh, my God, somebody's finally done it. They put a great book together. I could not type in our name fast enough. So congratulations on a great, great work.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Sales have really been great. LSU Press published it. They did an absolutely beautiful job with the book. And after only 5 weeks, they had to go into a second printing.
Well, so great. Fantastic.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I know a lot of times you spend so much time and effort and pour so much of your soul into a book. It's very rewarding to know that it's so well received. So sincere congratulations on that. Now, how did the project start, though? You know, we're celebrating the bicentennial of steamboat and riverboat travel. Was it related to that?
Not really. Actually, the Delta Queen was about to lose its SOLAS exemption, that Safety of Life at Sea Act. Congress was about to shut it down, and a publisher in Indiana knew that was going to happen. This was in 2008. So he contacted the Newcomb Culinary Group and said, you know what? Somebody needs to get out there and track down these chefs and get all their recipes before the boat goes out of business. So they nominated me for the job. I gladly accepted. I went and I tracked down pretty much all the surviving chefs, and they were all over the world. And they were more than happy to give me the recipes because the boat was going to go out of commission, and they thought this would be a great thing to do just to preserve the recipes. Now, the oldest chef that I got in touch with was a gentleman who actually cooked on the boat during World War II.
Oh, my God.
His name was Joe Cornyn out in California, and he gave me some wonderful stories about what they ate and how they did things back then. You know, the Delta Queen was part of the Navy during World War II. President Roosevelt had conscripted both the King and the Queen to be barracks for reservists. And they also carried the Pearl Harbor injured people from deep water through San Francisco Bay to on land hospitals.
Oh, my gosh. I did not know that.
But anyway, Mr. Cornyn gave me recipes from the World War II era. Unfortunately, he passed away just a few months before the book was published.
What a shame. I know that Terry Newkirk was in the book as well, and he had submitted a recipe. I know Terry, and I knew him for so many years when he was working at the Hilton and other places. So he worked on the boat as well, huh?
He did, and as a matter of fact, he gave me more recipes than anyone.
Yeah, well, he was a great record keeper, too. I mean, I'll never forget, he was on a committee at one point. That's how I know Terry, and I was so excited to see him in the book, and he always had all of the information that was needed on the chefs in New Orleans, so I know he had to be a good resource for you.
Well, he was, and as a matter of fact, I sort of dedicate the book to him, because he gave me so many recipes.
Right.
In the late 1980s, he standardized all the recipes for the Delta Queen and the Mississippi Queen. They were traveling together up and down the Mississippi, and they were part of the Delta Queen Steamboat Company, and he got all the recipes together and tried to make both boats cook exactly alike. Of course, that didn't happen. But
right, right.
He did try to standardize the recipes, and he gave me a stack, I bet, of 300 recipes. And it was really hard to pick out the favorites.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. Now, you know, tell us about the Delta Queen, the grand old lady of the river, and the world's last authentic, I guess I should say, overnight wooden steamboat. I know you had to get to know her intimately and know the people around. Tell us a little bit about what you found in researching the book.
Well, the Delta Queen was built with the Delta King, and they were christened in 1927. They started out in California, and surprisingly, they were named for the California Delta, not our Delta.
Right.
Most people think they were named for the Mississippi Delta.
Yeah.
They were not. And they were party boats, and they were built during Prohibition. And from my research, it's not written down anywhere, but from interviews.
Well, it stands to reason, I said.
That's why they were built. Because people could go and drink without anybody hassling them. So they would travel at night. One would start in San Francisco, one would start in Sacramento, and they'd go down the San Joaquin River, and they'd pass each other up. It took about between 5 and 7 hours for this trip, and they would have big bands and everybody would dance, and you had a room that you could stay in, but nobody really stayed in their rooms. They just go to have a good time. That's how they started. After Prohibition, naturally, when there started being bars on land, that hurt the two boats. So they lost a lot of business, and they ran into hard financial times, and they were about to go bankrupt when World War II started.
Uh-huh.
That's when they went into the Navy. So both boats stayed in the Navy during World War II. After World War II, they were both mothballed, but a company bought the Delta King, took her up to Alaska, and turned her into barracks for a construction company, which was not really a good deal for that boat.
No.
But the Delta Queen was bought by a gentleman named Tom Green from Cincinnati. And Tom Green was from a big steamboat family, Green Line Steamers in Cincinnati. He boarded the boat up, had her towed all the way down the Pacific through the Panama Canal, up the Gulf of Mexico to New Orleans. And the boat made history by doing that. That was the first steamboat to go through the Panama Canal. Made headlines all over the world. And there's pictures all over in newspapers of the Delta Queen going through the Panama Canal. Then the boat went on up to Cincinnati. And in Cincinnati, oh gosh, I think it stayed there for 36 years. So Cincinnati really likes to claim the Delta Queen as her own. As a matter of fact, I was there this week in Cincinnati speaking to a lot of folks who remember her intimately. They're all very sad that she's not running anymore, and they miss her.
Towns like St. Louis, towns like Cincinnati, even all the way up to the origin of the mouth of the river up in Minnesota and down to New Orleans, these are all great Natchez, Mississippi, Baton Rouge, great river port towns. Donaldsonville, Louisiana, as I was mentioning, that was the capital in the 1830s. Again, a great riverboat port town. And these towns, I'm sure, love to lay claim as Cincinnati would to something as historic as the Queen.
Tell us about your research and where you began the research. It's fascinating, and I know how difficult research can be, but how rewarding it is when you find that mother load of information. So tell us about where you got the most of your information and how you brought it all together.
Well, as I said, for the recipes, most of it came from Chef Terry Newkirk, and I was just so thrilled when I finally figured out who he was. And it took a while. It took a few months because I was going to all these chefs, and everybody would give me two or three recipes. And I thought, oh my gosh, how am I going to get a whole book out of this? Finally, I found Chef Newkirk, and that saved the day on the recipe part. As far as the narrative, which the book is half narrative on the boat, half history, I found a few former passengers who were very, very knowledgeable. One of them was Mr. Dale Flick up in Cincinnati. He was very helpful, giving me a lot of information. And then there was another lady by the name of Joanne Shan. She lives up in Ohio. And both of these people not only gave me tons of information that they knew, but they led me out to all kinds of people across the country who could help me out. So I lucked up onto people who were willing to help. Another big help was Captain Doc Hawley, who lives in New Orleans. I don't know if you know Captain Hawley.
I do.
He's a food historian himself, and he was a captain on the Delta Queen for many, many years. He wrote a beautiful foreword for this book, and he did the editing. And Captain Hawley, he's just a sweetheart. The boat's up in Chattanooga right now. We had a big reunion last week, the 85th anniversary of the Delta Queen, and Captain Hawley was supposed to join us, but he had fallen and broken his hip.
Oh, poor guy.
Couldn't make the trip.
Oh, mercy.
Everybody was upset because everyone knows him. But anyway, I would say from these three people, I was able to branch out and find people all over the country who had either been part of the crew or who had ridden on the boat. And they shared their stories with me, and that's how the narrative part came.
Michelle and I have been talking about collectors of menus with all the books we've written. We're always looking for the motherlode. You never quite find it. And then every now and then you'll run into a Terry Newkirk, and you get what you're looking for. I know you had to put your hands on a lot of interesting menus or ideas for cooking along the way. What was some of the most interesting menus you found on the Delta Queen?
Well, by far the most interesting menu was the Christmas dinner menu. This is from 1940 when the boat was a receiving ship for naval reservists. What I find interesting is that it's not very different from what we eat today. Let me give you a few things that they ate for Christmas in 1940. They had olives, pickles, celery, tom turkey, sage dressing, giblet gravy, cranberry sauce, all the same sort of thing
we eat. Sure.
Ham, mashed potatoes, beans, lettuce, bread, butter, mince pie. Now, they probably had the original mince pie was made with
mince meat, right?
Mm-hmm. Ice cream, candy, and coffee.
Well, you know, America was just coming into finding part of its own cuisine, and part of that cuisine is those southern flares you just talked about. I like the way he said, tom turkey.
Yeah.
You know, tom turkey. That was the adjective. When you look at descriptives on menus today, when it goes on and on, the writings you could almost put to music when we describe menus today, and they said, tom turkey, and that was enough.
That's
to say,
right.
But you also had, in the book, reprinted a menu from the 1930s.
Right.
Tell us about that one, because, John, I don't know if you've seen this. I love this menu.
This one's a little more interesting. In the 1930s, first of all, your whole dinner cost only $1,
which was,
by today's standards, wow, what a bargain, huh? You started out with hors d'oeuvres. You had anchovies on toast, imported salami, and fruit cocktail. Which, I don't think you'd have fruit cocktail today.
Well, yeah, but that was a new and exciting grouping of fruits that people had never seen before.
That's right.
So all of a sudden, they served in a nice claret cup, so you can imagine that was a big deal.
And the soups on this menu are scotch barley in a bouillon in cup, salad, lettuce, and tomatoes with mayonnaise. The fish was a fillet of Boston cod. The entrees were a little interesting. Fresh pig's knuckles.
It's all over menus today. I mean, it's amazing how they were ahead of the game.
They were. Braised red cabbage. Chicken patties a la Wren. I can't imagine what that is, R-E-I-N-E.
A la Wren is of the queen.
And then we went on to vegetables. Asparagus, string beans, and mashed potatoes. Strawberry shortcake for dessert. Coconut pudding, pies, ice cream, cakes, coffee rolls.
That was pretty elaborate when you think about it. We're talking about liver and onions being on all of these glamorous menus, and why was that? I learned after searching out the story to these awful type meats and these organ meats as to why did they have such a prominent place on the menu. We saw things like brains and kidneys, and talking to some just fabulous writers and historians on food, it came to note something that was pretty obvious. They said in those days, even going back to colonial Williamsburg, anytime you looked at a piece of meat on an animal, like the tongue, there was one tongue, but there was four roast. So the tongue became the delicacy. The cheeks of the calf, there was two cheeks. The head was one, so the head was always the centerpiece of the table. And the cheeks would have been for the guest of honor at the table. So whenever you got into what we consider today to be the primal cuts of meat, those were not that interesting. I like vegetables. You would never put vegetables across a classic table because even a commoner could grow it. So you look at this boat, fruit cocktail makes perfect sense. These arrays of fruit from different parts of the world or different countries make their way in. So liver and onions on the Delta Queen menu, that just meant that you had something very special.
Well, I'm going to mention these. You're talking about the organ meats, the Robert E. Lee,
sure,
which ran from 1866 to 1882, that went from New Orleans to Vicksburg. This was breakfast. beefsteak, mutton chops, brains, stewed kidney, jambalaya, fricassee of tripe.
There it is. Once again, I mean, perfect example of how these became Saturday plate items. They were so important because they were one of. Very, very interesting.
And Cynthia brought in a menu today, specials of the day from the 1930s.
Right.
It seems they kind of had an oyster bar a little bit. You know, I love this. You could have fried Eastern oysters. You could have fresh Eastern oyster stew. You could have roast oysters Rockefeller. You could have blue points on the half shell. You'd have been belly up.
Well, not only that, I mean, it just goes to show you their outreach to please multiple customers from different backgrounds. Because, I mean, Eastern oysters are totally different from warm Gulf oysters, totally different from blue points. I mean, and to imagine that they would be able to ship them in and get them cold and put them where they need to be. I mean, absolutely. I mean, they were trying to definitely impress an opulent guest. No
right.
doubt about it. That's what it was all about.
And they had fresh fruit, too. That was another thing that was on this menu, the fresh sliced peaches and the Florida cantaloupe.
The Delta Queen, as we said, just not plied the river for more than 82 years, and she must have witnessed, I mean, so many remarkable social, economic, political challenges and changes. Any stories that you uncovered about how she survived many of those?
You know, I would say the biggest challenge that boat went through was SOLAS, was actually the U.S. Congress, because beginning in the 1960s, they passed a law that said that any wooden boat could not travel overnight with more than 50 passengers. Well, the Delta Queen had 185 passengers and couldn't have made it with only 50 passengers. So she got an exemption starting in the 1960s, and through 2008, she got 9 exemptions. And every time that she was up for an exemption, it was a huge political deal. And there would be people waving banners and writing to Congress, please save the Delta Queen. And this happened every 3 to 5 years. Then she also saw a lot of different food challenges. It was often hard to keep things stocked on a moving steamboat.
Sure.
So whenever the steamboat would run out of certain things, they would stop at these little towns and they would run to the grocery store and buy what they needed. Also at all the different locks, back in the 50s and 60s, the lock masters grew vegetables. When they would stop at the locks to go up and down the river, the captain would go and buy vegetables from the lockmaster.
Well, Bradford was saying that's how his family really made money, not so much having the boats, because the maintenance and the labor was so expensive. He said they made their money servicing the boats that stopped at the dock. They had the coal bins, and they had the wood. They had people cutting wood for the boilers. He said they raised vegetables. Well, a fascinating book, y'all, and we certainly want to thank Cynthia for being here with us today and giving us that fabulous knowledge of riverboat cuisine. We want to congratulate you once again, Cynthia, for not only a fabulous book, but being so generous with your time, being here with us today. We will have all of your information on our website. And I thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
And congratulations on filling a niche that really needed, a story that really needed to be told. You've done a wonderful job of it. We appreciate it. And tell our girl, Sheremy, we said hello.
I certainly will. Sheremy's my walking buddy every morning.
Okay, well, we know you have to go to our book signing, so thank you so much for being here with us today. Thank you, and I'll see you soon.
Okay, bye.
Y'all, we'll be back in a minute.
Gonna be the record of the Robert E. Lee. Up then stepped a gambling man from Louisville, who tried to get a bet against the whippoorwill. Billy flashed the roll that surely was a bear. The boiler, it exploded, blew them up in the air. The gambler said,
not every composer could take the story of a loving father who gets his own daughter murdered and bring it to life in a moving opera. But it was no problem for Giuseppe Verdi. I'm Lisa Simeoni. Join me for Verdi's Rigoletto from the Royal Theater in Turin next time on World of Opera.
Monday night at 7 on KRVS.
Josh Collinet here with Banning Air, and we are getting ready to sample the best new music of 2012.
Desert blues, tucumbe, hip-hop, and bachata.
Hey, don't forget, boo-boo music. That's next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Konnichiwa. This is Emily with Rock Japan inviting you to join me late night Fridays at 3 a.m. and Mondays at 11 p.m. here on KRVS 88.7 FM. We'll explore the new, old, and experimental music of the island nation of Japan and how they rock the world from dusk till the rising sun.
We boarded the boat on the breast of the river so wide. And we left old St. Louis on the crest of that brown muddy tide. To the strange.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show and the best culture show on radio. I'm happy to say I love that song right there. That's a great little ditty right there.
That was.
Let's see. That was the Queen Waltz.
The Queen Waltz.
The Queen Waltz. Because there are a bunch of songs about the Delta Queen, because there was that whole political thing. And so a lot of bands and a lot of musicians got behind it. That song was the Queen Waltz by John Hartford.
John Hartford. Wow, that was really... I'd like to hear the rest of that at some point in time. You know, I wanted to ask you exactly what is the fate of the Queen now? What's going on with her? Did y'all have that conversation?
No, we didn't. We did not have that conversation.
She said it was in Cincinnati.
Cincinnati.
And that they just had the 80-something anniversary, so they had been up there. So I don't know whether it's dry docked up there and just open to the public as a museum or whatever it is, you know. But anyway, what a fabulous part of our history missing without seeing those going up and down the river again. I'm also wondering why they just at some point didn't make the decision to go ahead and put an iron hull on those ships. Must be a reason for it. I wasn't the first one to think of that. They still wanted to run that to quit taking that 182 passengers, but they had to come off of the river because they had wooden hulls. Why? Well, like the Natchez. Oh, look at the Natchez. Natchez is up and down the river, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's got a metal hull. It's staying a bit. Well, anyway, I guess that's a story for another day, right, huh?
And, you know, we should remind everybody about Facebook real quick before you forget.
Before I forget.
Facebook.com/stirringitupradio. We've been encouraging listeners to let us hear them. So
we want to hear about what you're doing out there. We want to see the pictures of your cuisine.
Well, to challenge our guests, make a Facebook challenge for Stirring It Up, and that is that they submit to us like a recipe or one of their dishes that families are just thrilled when they cook it for them or bring it to parties or whatever, and it could be anything at all.
That's a good idea, but what happens when I win?
You wouldn't be eligible.
You're disqualified.
You would not be eligible, and it has nothing to do with the fact that you're on the show. It has to do with your cooking techniques. Huh? So you're not eligible to be a part of this. But anyway, Slama, this is what I think we ought to do. We ought to challenge our guests to send us these photos. It has to be a photo. They have to be in it. And it has to be their famous dish that everybody wants them to make, or it's something they got from grandmother. They bring it to the Christmas tables. They bring it to Easter. They bring it to the tailgate parties, whatever it is. And they send us their little four-line story about why they should be a guest right here in the studio with Stirring It Up. They'll be our stove hound of the month. We'd invite them in, and Michelle could redo her scone recipe. And
I think that's a great
idea. That'd be kind of like a recreation of the stove hounds who used to come in and sit here and visit until we locked the door. We need to open the door and allow friends in.
All right, y'all, it's official.
Anyway, Slama, so you go ahead and handle that for us. You make sure you're encouraging those listeners to send in their stories, send in that picture, and make sure it happens. And, of course, y'all, we will have Cynthia Noble's information on our website, jfalls.com, and you definitely want to make sure that you pick up that book. Michelle, we're talking about books. What else do you have for our library this
week? Well, I definitely want to talk again about the Delta Queen Cookbook. Well, let me tell you the whole name, because we never did. The Delta Queen Cookbook, The History and Recipes to the Legendary Steamboat by Cynthia Lejeune Nobles. It was just published in September, and through the pages of the book, she really brings this grand old lady herself to life. I mean, the historical narrative, there are more than 125 recipes from former chefs of the steamboat. And you heard her story of actually talking to the different chefs through the years. It's a great piece of American history the Delta Queen's a national treasure and, of course, very much a part of Louisiana history as well. And it makes a great holiday gift. I know people are out there. I love giving books as Christmas gifts. And, of course, there are a lot of things to choose from. But for the foodies on your list or for the history buffs on your list or for those who just love to collect books and first editions, I definitely suggest the Delta Queen Cookbook by Cynthia Lejeune Nobles. We'll have her information on the website.
And Slam, I have to mention that going to the Facebook page, I know you were mentioning just now updating some things on our website, which I agree would be just absolutely fabulous. So you go ahead and run with that and give me whatever information you need. But I got a little posting here from Peggy. And I'm going to maybe mess up her last name here. Corinth, I think is the name of it. Her dad was the very famous Mr. Bernandi, who was the famous Creole tomato grower from St. Bernard Parish, Plaquemine Parish area. He was a guest on my first television series back in 1989. Oh, wow. My first PBS, national PBS show was in 1989. Mr. Sam Bernandi, as they pronounced it. Sam Bernandi was this beautiful Italian man who had a stall in the French Market of New Orleans. His whole family had been in the French Market for years and years and years, and they were renowned for growing beautiful Creole tomatoes. And Peggy writes that the Bernandi family misses you so very much. Dad passed away 3 years ago, but Mom is doing great at 84.
Aww.
Sam Bernandi, and I want to thank you. Anybody know the Bernandi family out there? You tell Peggy that I was definitely talking about her today. And, of course, our buddy David Hubble is always keeping our Stirring It Up pages lit up. David sent us a nice little thing the other day. He said he was pulling out that encyclopedia to make some homemade andouille again. He's a good andouille maker, too. I've tasted it.
You know, with this little contest we've got, we may have to have a runoff.
A runoff.
Because, yeah. Maybe don't just choose somebody. Maybe we have to bring in a couple of people over a period of time to taste their food.
That would be a good idea. They could come feed the judges. We're the three judges.
Oh, we get to be judges now?
I'll be the head judge, of course.
What does that mean, head judge? Does that mean you get a vote and a half?
There's three of us, so I get 1.75 votes. They could come in, and we choose two people to see who's going to be the
featured.
Well,
let's not limit ourselves.
Well, yeah, maybe one a week.
Yeah, let's not limit ourselves because I want to taste this andouille sausage.
That's the challenge, and it's legit. We are looking to have our Stove Hound of the Month as a guest on our show to talk about what they love about cooking, about their family recipes, where did it come from, what got them into cooking. That'd be a nice show where we also, whatever they're cooking, if it's melaton, then the show would have to be about melaton. If it's andouille, the show would have to be about andouille. It'd have to be about sausage. We'd have to support them, you see what I mean?
Of course we will.
Okay, that's what I'm thinking we're going to do. Talking about supporting them, do y'all want to hear a little recipe here?
I would love a recipe.
So, look, I have some choices today. I see you patting your stomach.
It's hollow. I'm going to have to eat one of these scones.
Good thing she brought three packs of those, huh? Now, these are all recipes from the cookbook. These are recipes from the Delta Queen cookbook, and we have a great banana pudding with meringue. Now, I took that because that was one of my favorite recipes from Mary Fascio. Mary would always make a good banana pudding.
Mm. Okay.
Oh, absolutely. She loved that. Crawfish en croûte and pastry shell. Crawfish and pastry shell was one of the favorites of, I'm sure, Terry Newkirk, and it kind of shows, again, the opulence of the food on the boat because it was obviously a very classy dish, crawfish en croûte. And then over here, let me see what the next one is. We have a Minnesota, because the boat went up to Minnesota, Michelle, so we have a Minnesota wild rice soup. You have a choice of the soup, the crawfish en croûte, or the banana pudding with meringue. Michelle, you're the judge. Which one do you want me to give you, huh?
Wild rice soup.
You like Minnesota wild rice soup.
Yeah,
I guarantee
different.
You that every one of our listeners in Radio Land said, you're kidding me, we said again, we want the crawfish en croûte. She chooses Minnesota wild rice. What? You just dropped 8 bars. I don't know.
I'm thinking that we're also overloaded at this time of year.
Yeah.
Throwing a little something healthy. But it is a season for delicacies. It is a season being a little more elaborate.
You definitely make a good argument for your selection. I like that, huh? And this is a healthy soup.
Was that an apology?
That was an apology. And unlike most dishes in Louisiana, this is a healthy soup. It has a pound of butter in it as opposed to our 1.5 pounds that we normally have.
It's only 1 pound.
Of course. I mean, cutting back is very important this time of year, Michelle. So wild rice is the official state grain of Minnesota, which is the highest point in the U.S. that the Delta Queen could travel to, and the only region in the United States where this aquatic grass, Michelle, is native to the country. That's the Indian wild rice. The seed of the wild rice plant was important to early Native Americans who could store it indefinitely after curing it. You had to cure the wild rice first. Lake rice refers to wild rice that grows naturally, while paddy rice is the name for the cultivated wild rice. So anyway, y'all, we're going to begin with 3/4 of a cup of uncooked wild rice, 3 cups of water, and 2 tablespoons of butter. And what we're going to do, we're going to combine the wild rice, the water, and of course I could even put a little bit of butter in there. And we're going to cover it and simmer it for 45 minutes until the rice is tender. Now, unlike the rice, the local white rice, the long grain or the short grain rice, the wild rice tends to be a little more dense in texture and needs longer simmering or boiling. So 45 minutes until it becomes tender. Reserve that water, by the way. Then you're going to melt the butter, and of course you got about a little, couple of tablespoons of butter here in a soup pot, heavy bottom soup pot always, so you don't scorch it. And then once the butter's melted, you're going to add garlic, which is about 2 cloves of fresh garlic, 1 carrot finely diced, 1 cup of finely diced celery, 1 cup of finely diced onions, and you're going to saute all of that around until it's transparent for a minute. And then you're going to add mushrooms, 1/2 cup of freshly sliced little button mushrooms, or if you live in Louisiana, yeah, little oyster mushrooms. They grow wild all over the swamps of Louisiana, and you're going to dice that in, and you're going to saute that as well. Then, of course, you can add a little bit salt and pepper and a little granulated garlic to that. Just kind of stir it in to season your vegetables. Then, Michelle, you're going to add about 8 cups of a chicken stock to that, but I want you to remember, strain that water that you boil the rice in, mm-hmm, and measure that into the 8 cups, because it's going to have a real, I'm going to say, a potent wild rice flavor, so you don't want to toss that rice out.
You know, and I have to say that that's something these many years, it's taken me how many years to learn, but I love that you reserve the liquid in so much, because it does add flavor. And there was a time when I thought, oh, you know, well, if I boil the meat to tenderize it or whatever, it's the meat that I'm trying to gain, not the water. But the water is delicious, and to add it in as the stock.
Well, it is the stock. If even the non-cook right now can imagine a cup of wild rice boiling away in a gallon of water, and it's going to boil for 45 minutes. I mean, what is that water going to taste like? Mm-hmm. It's going to taste like just a really luscious, rich wild rice broth is what it's going to taste like. So you certainly want that. So now that the carrots and onions and the celery and the mushrooms, the garlic, all sauteed, I added a little salt, pepper, granulated garlic to that. And then I'm adding the stock, which is also measured in with the reserve water from the wild rice boiling. And I'm going to let that come to a nice simmer. And I'm going to cook that for a couple of minutes. But I've also added into that, once I season it, Michelle, I wanted to add about 1/3 cup of flour. Maybe about 1/2 cup goes into that butter first before I put the water in, because I'm making a white roux, right?
Okay.
And remember the butter I put down in there, a quarter cup of butter? Now I'm going to put that 1/4 cup to 1/2 cup of flour down in there, and I'm going to stir it in with the vegetables, and I won't let it brown. I'll make that just a nice white roux. And then I'm going to add those 8 cups of stock and 1/3 cup. See, this is what makes this healthy. These are Minnesotans, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are Lutherans. What they're doing is adding 1/3 cup of heavy whipping cream, and they don't want to indulge, but like us rogue Catholics down here in New Orleans on the river, I would say 2 cups of heavy whipping cream into this dish along with my 1/4 pound of butter.
But you see, this is on the Delta Queen, so it's okay to be lavish.
That's exactly right. Anyway, so 1/3 cup of heavy whipping cream, 2 tablespoons of sherry, and then 2/3 cup of milk. See, they're coming back in with a lesser fat ingredient, milk, instead of just throwing all that good heavy whipping cream in there I would have thrown in. Then I'm going to add a little parsley to it. And then, of course, Michelle, they have to add that rice back in. And once the rice goes in, it's already cooked 45 minutes. So now the rice will cook another 15, which brings the rice to about an hour of cooking. And it's also a thickening ingredient, too, because rice is starch, right? So the rice has a tendency to want to fall to the bottom. So you have to stir the pot often to keep it from scorching or burning. And you have a wonderful, wonderful wild rice flavor. So look at the soup right now. Medley, you have a nice cream-based soup, rich, rich stock flavor. The wild rice has that black and white color to it, so it really looks nice. The carrots are in there, so you have a nice little golden look to it, yeah.
Can we add some crawfish?
Absolutely you can. Well, that's how foods become southern. You take good northern delicacies and you add more fat to it, add a little bit more root to it, you throw in a pound of crawfish and you say, yeah, we eat Louisiana. Anyway, y'all, the recipe is going to be on our website. You go to jfalls.com. It's all going to be right there for you. We do want you to remember our Facebook page, and we are challenging our stove hounds, right, Salama?
Yeah, let's see what you got out there.
You think we're going to get some response?
I think we'll get some crawfish for sure.
I think we'll get a lot of crawfish. I think we'll get a lot of pork.
Some andouille.
We're going to get a lot of sausage.
Great if we get a lot of andouille and sausage.
Boudin. In fact, the boudin people could come in first with their recipes. In fact, let me just say, anything with sausage or boudin, you get 5 extra points.
You think we'll get any brain breakfast?
I hope so. I love brains, man. We used to have brains.
Calf's liver and onions?
Calf's liver and onions, brains. I tell you what, Mr. Chewing Gum Poirier, I tell you what, when Chewing Gum came around, you could always get a little lanyapa, those extra brains. I'm thinking, always willing to give
brain
you a little
food.
Bit of brain food, absolutely. Anyway, y'all, again, we appreciate you being here with us. And you know what? Remember those great traditions that we're losing. Remember those things like those great, beautiful floating palaces that are floating out of our memory. How will your children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren know anything about it unless you remember to tell the stories? Be a raconteur. That's what we are, and we'll see you next week.